I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network. Read my lips, why Americans are proud to pay taxes. Vanessa Williamson is the author of a book just been released that has that title, and a timely conversation we'll be having with our taxes due actually on the 18th because of the weekend. She is a fellow in governance studies at the Brookings Institution, co-author also of The Tea Party and Remaking of Republican Conservatism. She spent the time between the summer of 2013 and the spring of 2014 conducting interviews with people all over the country, finding out what they think about taxes. And she asked them some very interesting questions. When you hear the word taxes, what comes to mind? Let's ask you that question this hour as well. When was the last time you paid any kind of tax at all? How does it feel to be a taxpayer? What kind of tax makes up the biggest part of your family's budget? And when you look at what you're happy to pay taxes for and what really irks you about paying taxes, what's on those lists? We'll be welcoming phone calls for our guest. Maybe some of you are doing your taxes as we speak, and you want to take a little pause and have a cup of coffee and hear this conversation and then resume your tax preparation. 143 million of us will spend about 8 hours on average filling out our income taxes. The book is very interesting. She also looks at the history, I think we'll start there, of the income tax here in the country. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we are on Twitter, and that's @KDunnShow. Vanessa, hello. Thanks very much for being with us.
Hello. I'm glad to be here.
Have you done your taxes?
I actually have not.
Oh, no.
I'll be spending my weekend.
You will. Yeah, you'll have to spend 8 hours, one whole day of your weekend, filling out your income taxes. Oh, so where do we get this idea you write about, that taxes are something that we hate doing, but it's not really true that we hate our taxes? Where do we get this idea that we do hate it?
Well, first of all, I mean, the income tax filing process is a real frustration for me.
Yes.
And that's perfectly reasonable, and it certainly, you know, puts the whole idea in kind of a bad light. But I think one reason that there's this pervasive idea that Americans hate taxes is because it sort of goes back to, you know, various tax revolts that we've had. Most memorably, I think, in the late 70s and early 80s, there was a move to cap property taxes across the country, and then you see, you know, the Reagan Revolution, and for the next, you know, 35 years, Republicans make an anti-tax position, you know, sort of a fundamental part of their party platform. So I think that the controversy over taxes, particularly among Republicans, makes us forget that at the end of the day, people see being a taxpayer as something, you know, as evidence that they're contributing to their communities. They may not like where their money goes. They may not think it's all raised in a fair way. But being a taxpayer is something Americans are very proud of.
Mm-hmm. When did we start paying taxes? Civil War?
Well, I mean, there have always been taxes of one sort or another. The income tax, the federal income tax, is first put in place during the Civil War. Disappears for a few years. It's declared unconstitutional because we're not supposed to have direct taxes at a federal level. And then there's a constitutional amendment. So by World War II or World War I, we have a new income tax in place.
When you went around the country asking people about taxes, did they have a pretty good understanding of all the taxes? Obviously, we're talking about income taxes because we're paying them by next Tuesday. But we pay other kinds of taxes as well, and some of us overlook the fact that all of us pay different kinds of taxes all the time.
That's exactly right. The federal income tax is such a prominent part of Americans' thinking, which is reasonable because there's this annual deadline that we're all thinking about. But it actually makes people forget taxes that are, in fact, more expensive to them over the course of the year. For instance, the sales tax or payroll taxes that pay for Social Security and Medicare. For people on the bottom half of the income spectrum, those definitely cost more.
Mm-hmm. Over, I thought this was interesting. You write that on state ballot measures over the past 3.5 decades, those measures intended to raise taxes have steadily and really steadily been more successful. What are those ballot measures and why are people voting to increase their taxes on that level?
Right. So for the last 40 years, there's been the steady increase in Americans voting for tax increases at the state level. Now, what kind of taxes varies a lot by area. Sales taxes get increased that way. Arizona did that a few years ago. Also, progressive taxes, California and Oregon, raised taxes on top earners. There have been tax increases on corporations. There have been cigarette tax increases. All kinds of taxes have been raised this way, where it's put before the voters and they choose. But what's interesting is, at the time of the tax revolt, so those were also tax measures, About 1 in 5 measures to increase taxes passed. Now it's about 1 in 2. That is, if you put a tax increase on the ballot in the last 15 years, you had a 50-50 shot of people voting yes.
And does that mean something that the federal government or some other entity is not taking care of the things that taxes pay for?
I think it's a combination of things. I think it's definitely true that when a state is facing budget shortfalls, Americans, you know, kind of step up to the plate a little bit. They don't want to see their schools get cut, their hospitals get cut. That's exactly right. But I think there's also perhaps more of a sentiment when people are writing this kind of legislation to explain where the money is going to go. And one of the main predictors of whether one of these measures passes at a local level is whether it includes an explanation of what they're going to do with the money, which is only reasonable, right? You don't want to pay for a cost with no explanation of the benefits.
Mm-hmm. And when you ask people the question, this may be a good time to ask this question, what are you okay with? Your taxes are going to this and that's fine with you. What are you not okay with that taxes are going to? What are the most common answers to both of those questions?
So I think you could divide our spending into three categories. The stuff that everyone likes, if they remember it, is local spending. So schools, roads, hospitals, parks, and, you know, most commonly remembered are things like schools and roads. People don't always remember things like the sewer system, but if they remember them, they're glad we have one. So those things are sort of universally popular. At the very bottom, things that people only mention if they don't like them are things like corporate aid is what I call it in the book, but, you know, bailouts, tax breaks for corporations, that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And the other thing on that list is foreign aid. No one I spoke to in any of my surveys mentioned foreign aid in a positive light. They only mentioned it if they dislike it.
Oh, that's interesting.
Mm-hmm. And then in the middle category is kind of everything else. So that's all the major components of the welfare state. You see spending on the poor, health care, as well as spending on the military. And those are in a mixed bag. They're pretty well remembered, but people are divided about whether they think that kind of spending is upsetting or good.
Mm-hmm. What's interesting here is people's perceptions of who's paying taxes and who's not. I think this is a knockout figure that you cite. A mere 8% of Americans are bothered most by the amount of money they themselves pay, but 67% say that either the rich or the poor or corporations are not paying their share.
That's right. So I think that, you know, there's this mistaken belief that Americans are very worked up about the amount of taxes that they personally pay. And it just isn't backed up by the data. If you look, if you ask people what bothers them most about taxes, that's what they say, that someone's not paying their share. Overwhelmingly, either corporations or the wealthy, and a small percentage of people say the poor. But this goes back to the idea that taxpaying is an important responsibility. You know, if you're paying your share, if you're chipping in, doing something that you think is important for the country, of course you're angry if you think other people aren't doing their part.
Mm-hmm. There's also a breakdown here between perhaps those who have more and those who don't have very much. There's a concern, and I'm wondering who shares this concern, that minorities may benefit from public spending. It's a very common source, you write, of tax opposition.
That's exactly right. So there's a long history in this country of racialized ideas about who's benefiting from government, right, dating back to the 60s and earlier, that welfare spending is benefiting minorities more. And obviously that's not backed up by the facts, but people have very strong sort of symbolic racial attitudes. And so what you see is a decline in support for welfare spending as people come to associate that spending with minority groups. And you see that travel on today, and one thing that I think is particularly salient in the current moment is a perception widely held that immigrants don't pay taxes.
Right.
Of course, they pay taxes. And in fact, undocumented immigrants often pay Social Security and Medicare taxes because they are using a fake Social Security number that they can never then access. They're actually propping up our Social Security and Medicare system.
Mm-hmm.
But people have a notion that lower-income people, and especially minorities and especially immigrants, aren't doing their part.
Well, and it's reinforced by politicians' rhetoric sometimes, right?
Absolutely. You know, there's definitely an unfortunate rhetoric, particularly, I think, on the conservative side, sort of emphasized this idea that some people aren't paying their share. You know, you may remember the comments by Mitt Romney a few years ago now about the 47% of people who don't pay net federal income taxes and how these people are a drain on the system. And, of course, you know, that, first of all, is a huge percentage of America.
Mm-hmm.
But secondarily, of course, many people don't pay federal income taxes, but of course they're paying payroll taxes and sales taxes and all the other kinds of taxes. Spreading this idea that a very large percentage of America isn't doing its part on something that people think of as really important, right, paying for your community, it's really, I think, toxic to, you know, having a sense of shared responsibility and sort of a shared set of goals in this country.
And what about the question, are the wealthy, the very wealthy in this country, paying their fair share of taxes? Is there concern about that?
Absolutely. So when people say what bothers them most, you know, it's sort of evenly split between corporations and the wealthy at the top two things people are concerned about, those two groups not paying. But, I mean, I think it's actually worth recognizing, at least it's understood, is the reality that the American tax system is actually remarkably progressive by international standards because we rely on an income tax rather than a VAT, which is sort of like a sales tax, a national sales tax. So our tax system is actually more progressive than many countries that are more progressive on the spending side. So we have a system where wealthy people do, in general, end up paying more than lower-income people, more as a percentage, until you get to the very, very, very top. So once you're talking about making tens of millions of dollars a year, then, you know, and these are only a couple thousand households, but then you see, first of all, leveling off and then a dip down, right? So at the very, very top, people may not be paying a larger percentage than people lower on the income spectrum, but for most of America, the vast majority of people, progressive taxation actually works.
Mm-hmm. How difficult is it for us to determine our tax costs against what we receive from the government in terms of giving us something for those taxes?
Well, of course, it's very difficult to think about all the different taxes you pay. I've actually made an effort to do this for myself. I was curious. And, you know, if you think about adding up every time you go to the store and buy something that says sales tax applied, thinking about all of that money going to Social Security, Medicare, plus, you know, going back and looking at your income tax, plus thinking about every time you put gas in the car, you know, there are all these different
things
to bear in mind. It's hard to work out those costs, so no wonder people are confused about who's paying what. And then if you think about that is compared to benefits, that's really complicated too, because not only are, you know, is it hard to put a price on public goods, right? How much is it worth it to me that there are roads, that there is clean air, mm-hmm. that everyone in this country gets educated? I don't know how to price those things, right? How much is it worth to me, you know, we're paying veterans benefits, how much is it worth it to me that we won World War II? I don't know how I could possibly calculate it. Obviously, I'm getting more from my country than I could possibly give on these huge, you know, public goods. And then, you know, at the end of the day, all of my private property is protected by our legal system. So I think that there's a real challenge in doing a real cost-benefit analysis the way you would with buying a product at a store. And I think that's part of the reason why people tend to think of taxes differently. They think of it more like military service. It's like something you do for your country.
Hmm. Well, let's talk about the military, because the president wants to add $54 billion to the military. Are military contributions something that people see as a great benefit to them? Do they think that the amount of tax dollars going to the military is excessive or not?
Well, I think that there's certainly a lot of concern, particularly on the left side of the spectrum, that too much is being spent on the military. But some of it is actually just a difference of terminology, right? Support for service members is very, very high in both parties, right? Making sure that people who are in the military have what their needs, that their families are looked after. Of course, Americans are overwhelmingly willing to support those things. Where you start to get concern is on military spending that's going overseas, right? So, first of all of the foreign military interventions that have been occurring constantly for the last years now. And then also sort of wrapped in with that, which I thought was interesting when I was doing interviews, wrapped in with that the idea of foreign aid. And it's one of the reasons you may have heard the statistic that, oh, Americans think a quarter of the budget goes to foreign aid.
I know.
Actually, it's 1%. Well, it's true that Americans overestimate the foreign aid budget, but not nearly by that much, because a lot of that overestimate comes from people who are just using the phrase foreign aid differently from a professional policymaker. Many people, when they say foreign aid, are taking into account a lot of the spending that's happening in, say, a place like Afghanistan, which is technically in the military budget, but we also do a lot of, you know, civil affairs stuff. We also do a lot of rebuilding, and so it's not obvious what technically counts as foreign aid and what technically counts as military spending, particularly because some foreign aid is security aid.
Mm-hmm.
So some of that confusion, I think, is overstated, but there's a vastly more support for making sure that our service members and veterans have what they need, and much more concern about whether the sort of engagements of the U.S. military in recent years are productive or are really in our national interest.
I wanted to ask you more about this. In the South, you write, there was a wave of property tax caps inspired by threats to the existing racial order. What's that all about?
So some of your listeners may remember the recent round of property tax caps from the late 70s and early 80s. There was actually a much earlier one that happened in the post-Reconstruction period. So after the Civil War, black people are given suffrage, and you know, run for office, serve in the House of Representatives, all kinds of things. And that persists in for almost two decades. But at that point, what you see across the South is moves to return to what they referred to as, you know, euphemistically, as rule of the taxpayer, which meant rule by propertied people, which were wealthy white people. And so you see, you know, the institution of poll tax, of grandfather clauses, things that keep black people from voting and also poor white people from voting in many cases. And so, you know, it's an interesting example of how that idea of who counts as a taxpayer is really a fight about who counts as a citizen.
Mm-hmm.
And it sort of, I think, echoes many of the fights that we're seeing today. I mean, people like Steve Bannon and Michelle Bachmann have both talked about having the suffrage be restricted only to people who pay taxes. So, which, you know, echoes this very dark chapter in American history.
Yeah, and really, when you look at the way that we were founded, that people couldn't vote unless they owned property, and they were guys, right? I mean, it goes way back.
That's exactly right. I mean, the path to universal suffrage has been very long and has turned back on itself any number of times in American history. And I think that, you know, the fights we see today about who qualifies as a taxpayer is a way of talking about who's a real American or who's a real citizen who's doing their part. And it's recapitulating some of these same divisions that we've been struggling with in our society since our founding.
Mm-hmm. Do you think most people, when you took that survey of Americans, agreed with, I really like this statement from Oliver Wendell Holmes, taxes are what we pay for civilized society?
I mean, I think that's a very common we held belief. In fact, I've even had interviewees say that to me.
Have you?
I remember this quote, which I'm taken aback by. I thought that was the kind of obscure thing only someone who studied taxes would know, but it's not true. No, I think that it's widely believed. I think on both sides of the aisle, in fact, Republicans in surveys are slightly more likely than Democrats to describe taxpaying as a moral responsibility. So, yeah, I mean, it's very, very widely held belief. You, something like between 90 and 95% of Americans see paying your fair share as a civic duty. So we have these very strong commitments as a people, and nearly consensus-level commitments to taxpaying as evidence of contributing to your community and also evidence that you deserve to be listened to by your government.
Our guest this hour is Vanessa Williamson. Her book is Read My Lips, Why Americans Are Proud to Pay Taxes. Do you agree with the sentiments of Oliver Wendell Holmes that taxes are what we pay for civilized society? As you fill out your income taxes, if you haven't already done so in the next few days, are you proud to be doing so? If you look at what you don't like paying taxes for, what's on that list? What do you like paying taxes for? Do you think that we all share the burden equally, or are poorer people getting a break and rich people getting a break? What do you think? Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. The email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook is The Kathleen Dunn Show. We're on Twitter at K Dunn Show. Vanessa Williamson is a fellow in governance studies at the Brookings Institution, and she's also co-author of The Tea Party and The Remaking of Republican Conservatism. This is the Ideas Network. All right, we have a ton of phone calls coming in for Vanessa. Let's go to Sally in Middleton first. Hello, Sally.
Hello, and thank you so much for this very timely help. I'm 85, and I remember a few years ago that being told by an accountant that, well, when you get in your 80s, there are only two things you really need to worry about. That's declare, and you have to declare any interest that you earn. But I've forgotten what the second thing is. Do you know what the other thing is that I've got to be sure I declare?
Oh, I've got to tell you, one of the things that I always told my interviewees is, you know, because people, when you ask them if they want to do an interview about taxes, like, oh, well, I'm not an expert on taxes. I'm like, I'm not an accountant. So, no, I'm blessed to be at an institution here at Brookings that has a tax policy center full of people who understand the ins and outs of all kinds of tax policy. But I am on the details of how to do your taxes as informed as the average person, I would say.
Do you do these by yourself, Sally?
Yes. Well, I've had help through the years, like when I bought my house. But this accountant is very good. But the last time I saw him, that's when he said, well, as you he brought in the age aspect. So,
right.
Well, since you're in your 80s, the only thing you have to worry about is declaring the any interest you earned.
And
what was the other thing he warned me about? I can't remember.
Yeah, can you call him?
I could, but wouldn't she know? Wouldn't
no.
If you get in your 80s, there are two things you have to declare.
Yeah,
I'm afraid not. No, I'm not. I'm not an accountant myself, so I couldn't possibly offer tax advice.
Yeah, Sally, call him back and find out what it is. Otherwise, you'll be in a state of consternation, and you don't want to be when you got to do your taxes. Thank you very much for your call, and let us go to Gary in Fitchburg. Hi, Gary.
Hi. You know, it seems no matter who is in the presidency and the Congress, we seem to be spending too much money, way, way, way too much money on military adventurism around the world. I think we have 37,000 troops in Germany. You know, Mongolia has a high-speed train. The United States has zero high-speed trains. We have so much money going to pay for taking care of the people that serve in the war, the veterans, after these wars. And what have we accomplished? Nothing other than bankrupting our country. And, you know, this needs to change. We need high-speed trains. We need a new energy grid. I would say bring the troops home, put them to work, building high-speed trains, and put them to work on organic farms.
Yeah. We're going to ask about the military spending in just a moment. Gary, what do you, when you look at your taxes, you say, oh, it's okay, I'm spending money on this. Are you happy with where part of your taxes is going? Oh, Gary, you're gone. I'm sorry, we didn't get an answer. What about military spending? Do we spend a huge part of the pie, percentage of the pie in military spending or not, Vanessa?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, military spending in the United States is exceptionally high. We are a rich country anyway, so even if we spend a small percentage, it would still look large. But compared to other countries, the amount that we put into our military is extraordinarily high. And I think the caller was really, you know, making a distinction that many Americans hold, which is, you know, taking care of troops and veterans on one hand, something he sounded clearly supportive of, versus this question of spending that occurs overseas. And I think that view is actually very widely held.
Yeah. Well, the amount of money that's spent on these bombs is phenomenal. I guess we dropped what's been called the mother of all bombs on Afghanistan, on an ISIS target today. That must have cost a huge amount of money, right?
The number I saw, and it's mind-boggling, and I am not a military defense expert, was $300 million.
Wow.
But, you know, once numbers get that large, I think this is, you know, and it's a common problem for everyone, once numbers get that large, they stop having real meaning for people, so it makes it hard for people to judge what their government is doing. One of the interesting things that I found in my book is that, you know, a lot of people talk a lot about government waste, right? If you ask Americans what percentage of every tax dollar do you think is wasted, the average estimate is about 50%. And it's not that, you know, half of our tax dollars people think are going, you know, are falling off the truck, as it were, you know, or sort of going through, getting through processes that are so inefficient that half the money gets wasted. Instead, what people are often thinking about is programs they dislike.
Mm-hmm.
And they're describing those as waste, which is very reasonable from, you know, in terms of how a normal person speaks, as opposed to, you know, a sort of policy expert who has a very specific technical definition of waste. But I think the one example of that, particularly on the left, is things like our ongoing military conflicts are sort of seen as wasteful, not just because they are perhaps conducted inefficiently, but because the whole purpose, as the caller suggested, isn't clear. The benefit of the entire endeavor isn't clear to them.
Let's go next to Gary. I'm sorry we missed the rest of that call. Scott in Appleton. Hi, Scott.
Good afternoon. How are you?
Good. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. We submitted our taxes. The question that my wife and I normally have is, what's the best reason for and against establishing a flat tax rate for the country? It would just seem to simplify so many things.
That's a great question. So typically speaking, if you ask people, you know, whether they support a graduated income tax like the one we have or a flat tax, a majority of people support a graduated income tax that applies a higher percentage rate to higher earners than lower earners. Well, a flat tax applies the same percentage to everyone, but 5% of $100 versus 5% of $1 million, it would be more money, but it wouldn't be a higher percentage, right? So that's the basic idea behind a progressive tax system versus a flat tax system. Support for a flat tax, I heard a lot of from my interviewees, and it tended to come from the position of wanting people to contribute equally to the country, right? That there's sort of a need to have an equal commitment. We're all citizens. We should all chip in at sort of what feels like an equivalent rate. Now, people sort of like that idea in principle, but then as they think about it, you know, in an interview, people can sort of talk at some length, and they would often kind of talk themselves out of the idea because they would confront the fact that, you know, you set a tax rate, and it's an imaginary number, 10%. Well, for a lower-income person, 10% could be really painful, right? If you're taking $2,000 away from someone who is only making $20,000, right? Mm-hmm. And then at the very upper end, that doesn't really seem fair either because it's quite small. That the last 10% of, if you're making $20 million, that last 10% of that doesn't, it's not going to feel the same, right? So what people would often consider to themselves is, perhaps what we need is equality of sacrifice, not necessarily the same percentage, but so that no one is having to give more than they can afford. So it should be based on your ability to pay, and therefore we should have a progressive tax system. So I think that those were the sort of considerations that people tended to bring to bear. On the one hand, doesn't it sound good to have a simple system? And there's also a fair amount of confusion. Sometimes people believe that if you had a flat tax, you wouldn't have loopholes. Well, I mean, conceivably, but people worry that if you had a flat tax with no loopholes, maybe rich people would actually end up paying more. The numbers on that usually don't work out when you do the math, but people sometimes thought that was a possibility. Mm-hmm. So on the one hand, people want a flat tax system because it's simple and because it feels equal, and we think that citizens should be equal. And on the other hand, there's the reality of income inequality in this country that means that if you apply those numbers to, actual people with very divergent incomes, it begins to feel quite unfair. It doesn't feel like an equal sacrifice at all.
Mm-hmm. Anything else, Scott?
Okay, thank you very much. I guess I wonder when my tax return was 64 pages when we printed it out.
Oh.
You wonder if there isn't a simpler way to do it.
Yeah.
I mean, I think that's a very widely held concern. The thing that takes up all the pages isn't the rates. It's it's the credits, the deductions, the figuring out your income in the first place. And a flat tax system would not necessarily simplify that. I mean, another way of saying that is you could simplify the tax code without making it a flat tax. You could simplify the tax code and still have, a series of rates that apply at different income levels.
Yeah. Or simplify the forms, because you can, 8 hours average, I bet for a lot of people it's more than that. And you get your headaches and you get mad at people. And it's just, that whole process is not a lot of fun.
Well, and it's really, for most people, in principle, is unnecessary, right? Because if all you have is your wage, your salary income, the IRS already has those documents from your employer. Mm-hmm. Most of your, and if you don't earn a high salary, you're not going to get any particular advantage from itemizing. So for many, many people, the IRS could basically fill out that form for you. And you wouldn't actually have to go through this difficult process, but that's not the system that we have.
Mm. Do they have enough workers to do that for us?
Well, there was an effort to try this out in California, a big state. They wanted to offer people the opportunity to have, pre-filled out forms if they wanted them. And, of course, you could then, say, no, I'm going to do it myself and save myself a bunch of money, maybe.
Right.
Or do it myself and find out that I got the same result, it was not a policy that went over well with the tax preparing industry. And so I think that
I'm sure that's
there was
true.
There was some substantial lobbying against that kind of a simplification.
Yeah, I'm sure there was. Thanks, Scott, for your call. Vicki in Richland Center, hi.
Hi. I'm actually from Lake Mills, just driving through Richland Center. But thank you for having me on. And I do have a question about churches and taxes and exactly how did that start? And, should they be paying taxes now, especially seeing as they seem to be driving policy as well as advocating for specific candidates? And how much are my tax dollars covering them? So I guess those are my concerns.
All right, Vicki. Thanks.
Right. So this is an important consideration. The United States is in some ways unusual for having a tax system that exempts nonprofits. That includes churches, includes all kinds of nonprofits. And one thing that scholars think that this may have done is actually help drive a sort of ideological polarization. It's not the main factor at all, but it's sort of an interesting side factor that people think, because you end up with each side, each party setting up all these nonprofits to first of all support their candidates, but also to come up with policies. And because it sort of happens outside of the party system, there's not much moderating influence. So you can set up these nonprofits that are really very extreme. And actually, something as someone who lives and works in D.C., I've seen so many of these organizations be founded, have a real role in policy making. So yeah, I think that there is something to be said for the concern that we've set up a tax system where at the political extremes you can really sort of fund your own idea, producers and your own facts, and that's really can be quite damaging for public discourse. But there are also, of course, for people who think that social policy is something we should be conducting through the tax code, there are plenty of reasons to want to provide a break to the many organizations that do all kinds of really, valuable charity work at a local level. So I think that there's a mixed, there are arguments on both sides, certainly.
Thanks so much, Vicki, for the call. Let's talk about this whole idea of what we're entitled to, life, liberty, the pursuit of happiness. A lot of this is related to our taxes. Do we believe that all of us, and it should be paid for in terms of taxes and then distributed to people who are in need, all of us are entitled to health care? Are we all entitled to food? Are we all entitled to some kind of housing?
I mean, this is a question about which people do not all agree in the United States. I think that there is a remarkable and I think somewhat underreported level of public support for the major components of our social safety net. So making sure that sick people can get health care, making sure that people who lose their job, don't fall into poverty, making sure that kids can get a decent education, making sure that kids' economic opportunities are not limited by their parents' circumstances, right? So these are things for which Americans believe we should pay, the government should pay for, and therefore the taxpayers should pay for. And people are remarkably willing to say in surveys that they'd be willing to support a tax increase for these sort of major versions of the social safety net. I should say also, of course, looking after the elderly is another sort of thing that the government does that people are very supportive of. But of course, when it comes to looking after the poor, that's where you begin to see much more divided attitudes, much more partisan attitudes, and that very much hinges on often your ideas about whether poor people are poor by circumstance or by choice, right? And so that's something that the two parties describe in very different terms.
Mm. We have a ways to go when it comes to empathy in this country, doesn't it?
Mm.
Let's go to Mark in Richland Center. Hi, Mark.
Hello. Thank you for this, and I thank you, the guest, to the point that you made with regard to the illegal immigrants actually at some level holding up the Social Security system, because no illegal immigrant actually can collect on that which was withheld, because that becomes fraud. So there is a substantial support to the Social Security system that is being provided by illegals. But to the question of war and how we get roped into it, it really is not only taxes, but it's the creation of money itself. So David Graeber, in his book, Debt the First 5,000 Years, discusses how any empire, any king, any monarch needed to have the support of the people. In order to get that, he would simply issue the currency, pay the currency to the military, and require that the taxes be paid in the form of the currency that he had issued. We have that same system, and so being roped into what otherwise most people do not support in this militaristic world that we're in, it comes not only just from taxes, but it comes from the fact that we believe that there has to be an issuer of the currency, and we believe that that issuer should be our government instead of ourselves. If money itself comes into existence only after some doing has been done and then recognition is given to that, then it takes away the entire authoritarian structure of issuance and then taxation back and then roping people into that which they do not want.
Vanessa.
Well, I think that one of the most important things to remember about taxes is that they are mandatory. And, you know, I think that an important question is, when is something that is mandatory legitimate, right? And, you know, I mean, that's one of the things that governments do, is impose things that are mandatory on all citizens. And I guess at an extreme level, you could start to think about other kinds of systems. But all my question, sort of within, you know, the practical and immediate American context, is how can we have representation be good enough in this country that we're happy about our taxation? Right? How can we have a government that represents what people believe and what people want well enough that the coercion that is involved with having a military or having taxation or really having any form of government at all is acceptable? It's legitimate to us. And I think that that's, you know, a source of real tension right now. I think that particularly as the parties have polarized, it has become increasingly common for people to see, when the other party is in power, that the government is not legitimate. And so I think that that's a real challenge as we, you know, in for the foreseeable future, is how do we, you know, make the government something that people see as a fair representative mm-hmm. of their views, or even if you're not getting your own way all the time, because that's not what democracy is, you don't get your own way all the time, at least that the range of things that happen that are happening are acceptable to you. You know, that they are, you know, this isn't the policy I choose, but it's the policy that most of my fellow citizens chose, and so I'm willing to live with that.
Mm.
But I don't think people feel that way all the time.
Yeah, a version of taxation without representation, but what's the threshold for how many Americans have to agree with a certain kind of policy for people to feel that it's not taxation without representation, that it is taxation without representation?
Right, I mean,
that's 60%, 70%?
Well, I think that that's, you know, one of the great sort of stories of American history, right, is this idea, okay, we don't want taxation without representation. Well, what does that mean? It means that, first of all, you have your suffragists who are like, well, you know, women are getting taxed. Why don't we have representation? You know, and you see the same thing in the civil rights movement, that there was a concerted effort to demonstrate, particularly around the issue of schools, that black Americans were being taxed often at very unfair, high rates in their property taxes to support schools that they then could not send their kids to. Mm-hmm. Right. So it has long been part of our history that we fight over the issue of taxation as a way of demonstrating our worthiness for citizenship and demonstrating that us not being represented, whatever group not being represented, is unfair. Right. And so I think that, you know, that continues to be a tension. And I think it's actually one of the things that is really great about taxes is that it gives people that sense of stake, and it gives people a sense that they should have an authority over their government. And, you know, in a democracy, that's what we want. We want people to feel that this is their government, that their elected officials work for them.
Let's take an email from Michael from Herbster, Wisconsin. As a self-employed person, tax time can be painful, both in the logistical hurdles of actually preparing your tax forms, but also in the amount of taxation you face as a small business person. It's always struck me as anti-small business. You write about corporations and businesses in your book. Is it anti-business?
Well, I think that there's a real sense of unfairness among small business owners. This is not the first time I've heard it about the taxes that they face versus the taxes that very large businesses face, right? Or rather, if you're a small business owner and you're working out all your Social Security taxes and all these things that you're, you know, the genuinely logistically difficult things you have to handle, and there's no way that you're going to have some offshore account and hide your profits overseas. There are all the things that, you know, people imagine, and largely accurately imagine, very big businesses have access to. And so I think that that sense of unfairness, it's not typically, you know, as I pointed out earlier, it's not that people think that their own amount that they pay is unfair. It's just that they think that it's unfair compared to other people who are getting a special and unfair break.
Let's welcome more phone calls. We're speaking this hour about our income taxes, and it's not something we all hate to do. There are only 8% of us who believe that it's unfair to us. Most of us believe that it's something that we're proud to do. Thus, the title of Vanessa's book, Read My Lips, Why Americans Are Proud to Pay Taxes. We do, however, have different ideas about who's getting away with things, who's not paying enough taxes, where tax dollars are going. She covers all of that. We'll talk more about corporate business taxes. Some politicians have said that we have the highest corporate tax rate in the world. Others are saying that's not the case. Those rates are to be lowered in this administration. How much of all the money that is redistributed comes from corporate taxes. We'll talk about that as we continue, and we'll be welcoming more of your phone calls. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@WPR.org. Our Facebook page, The Kathleen Dunn Show. Twitter is @KDunnShow. This is the Ideas Network. All right, let's go back to phone calls. 800-486-8655. Roger in Park Falls, Wisconsin. Hello, Roger.
Yes, hello. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My inquiry is regarding an article I read about Eric Trump's winery in Virginia, where he proposed to hire 29 more foreign workers to plant vines and pick grapes for TIF 1072. The attorney for the company suggested that it's hard to employ people. Looking it up, the cost of living in Virginia is $15.70 an hour versus the offered $10.72. I'm wondering how you resolve that with your guest's remark about value-added tax in Europe and how it doesn't work here. It won't help.
Did you get that, Vanessa?
Oh, I think that, yeah, I
okay. It was sort of hard
to hear. I think that it was there's a little bit of a misunderstanding. So I was not saying particularly that a value-added tax wouldn't work. I was merely saying that we don't have one. So a value-added tax is like a sales tax in its effect overall, so that it, for instance, tends to be a bit of a regressive tax. That is to say that poorer people end up paying more under a value-added tax system than under an income tax, a graduated income tax system like the one that we have. So because the United States relies on an income tax rather than a value-added tax, we tend to have wealthier people paying a higher rate than in many countries in Europe.
So let's talk more about corporate tax. How much corporate tax do we need? What percentage of the pie does it make up in terms of the money that we need to redistribute? And is it true that corporate taxes in this country are higher than any other country in the world?
So to take the second part first, the statutory corporate tax rate and what companies actually pay are not at all the same thing. So if you look at what companies are actually paying, we're sort of in the middle of the pack. But on paper, it looks like the rate is very high. So I think that's sort of a common example of politicians taking advantage of the complexity of the tax system to spread misinformation. That said, I think that what we're likely to see this year, there's talk of tax reform, but I think that it's far more likely that what we will end up with is, rather than sort of a broad tax reform that actually simplifies matters, simply a series of very top-heavy tax cuts.
Carol is next in Mount Horeb. Hi, Carol.
Hi. First of all, I would like you to say the name of your guest's book again. I've been driving, and now that I'm sitting still in my car, I can write it down because I didn't get it. And I have two comments. One is that I've been saying for years that people who have more need to do more. And in lots of different ways in our lives, and in reference to taxes, I think that's true as well. And so I really do hope that in time, people who make a lot more actually pay based on that. And it does seem like people who have less and are less fortunate in lots of ways are being unfairly penalized, even though they don't make very much money. As we said earlier, 10% of $20,000 is a lot if you are only making $20,000. So that was my comment. And then one more thing that I wanted to say is, over the years, my husband and I have used to always do our own income tax, and over the years it's gotten more complicated, so we now have an accountant who does it. And I'm so thankful that we have an accountant who does it. And each year when I write a check to him for having prepared our taxes, I also include a thank you note for keeping both of us out of divorce court because doing our taxes was so stressful. And so anyway, I just thought there might be a little levity in that because it isn't fun. So thank you for the show.
Yeah, thanks,
and I hope you say the name of your book one more time.
Yeah, the book is Read My Lips, Why Americans Are Proud to Pay Taxes. The author, our guest, is Vanessa S. Williamson. Read My Lips. You can remember that. Why Americans Are Proud to Pay Taxes. Vanessa.
So I thank you very much, particularly for your interest in my book title. It warms an author's heart. You put all these years of effort in, so it's
I'm
good.
Sure.
I would like to read it. On the point that you were making about people who, who have more should do more, I think that that is, first of all, a lovely, succinct sentiment, and also, I think, something that many people would agree with. You know, they don't always have such a simple and direct way of putting it, but typically speaking, when people support a progressive tax system, it's because of they believe that wealthy people can afford it. They can afford to pay. So, that what we're asking of Americans in the tax system is that people make an equal contribution according to their abilities. So that's, I think, one of the major reasons why most Americans on surveys support a graduated or progressive income tax as opposed to a flat tax, which faces the problem of not being able to take into account the fact that people at the very bottom, even a small percentage, can be quite painful for them, and people at the top, they could pay a lot more, and it wouldn't make any real impact in their style of life.
Mm. So. I'm wondering if when you interviewed people, I don't know if you were privy to how much money they make, but I'm wondering among those who are very, very rich in this country, are they very proud to pay taxes? Do they feel it's their responsibility, and maybe they should be even paying more? Do the poor feel that they're being unduly burdened?
So that's a great question. So I did, the survey did include information about everyone's economic status, because I tried to calculate, in addition to asking people what they thought their biggest tax was, I tried to calculate it myself based on the sort of survey information they have and some policy tools that are available to help you calculate approximately what people pay in different kinds of tax. So I did ask that. I spoke to people who are quite well off, but no one in that millionaire, billionaire class, I would say, mm-hmm. Or at least certainly not in a billionaire class. So I spoke to people who were, for instance, who retired after a career in military contracting. They were quite well off. I spoke to a federal attorney. I spoke to a retired lieutenant colonel. So I spoke to various people who, were certainly comfortably off, but I did not speak to George Soros or anyone like that. So there is some work in political science trying to identify the views of the extremely wealthy, the sort of billionaires, and there are actually not very many of them. So at the end of the day, if you can interview them, you can reach quite a large percentage of them relatively quickly. As a general rule, I think that data has found that the very, very wealthy are socially very liberal, but economically not as liberal. So that on issues like taxation, they're not as progressive as they look on social issues like, gay rights, that kind of thing. I did speak to quite a lot, because there were, of course, many more of them. I spoke to quite a lot of people who are very low income. And the thing that really struck me over and over again was how painful the sales tax could be, particularly in states that have a sales tax on food, grocery store food.
Yes.
And quite a few states do have that. And so people in places like Mississippi and Kansas, when they're paying 7% every time they go to the grocery store, it works out to the cost of a month of groceries over the course of the year. And if you're very low income, you really feel that. And so, I was struck over and over again by people who were really, counting their pennies to get to the register, and then they had to take into account the tax. It was very painful. And what kind of made that especially, I think, poignant for me is that speaking to middle-income people or those above that, that struggle was almost completely invisible. People tended to assume that very low-income people don't really pay much in taxes, so it's not a concern for them. When the reality is, you take 7% out of someone's grocery
right.
when they're barely scraping by, actually, those people are contributing, in terms of sacrifice, far more than plenty of other people.
Yeah, so, only one of the reasons your book is important, and we're out of time. Thank you, Vanessa, so much for being with us. Good luck with your taxes over the weekend.
Oh, my goodness, thank you.
Vanessa Williamson, the book is Read My Lips, Why Americans Are Proud to Pay Taxes. And I want to thank Judith Sears-Poisson for producing this hour. Thanks to Colleen Duvall, who's leaving us today, and we thank her for doing all this production for the last few months. Wish her well as she goes on to new challenges. Thanks for listening. Thanks for all of your calls.